iTunes. Like us on facebook.com/stage_studio. Till next time, I'm Dee Mae Roberts. We're going out with music by David Arnett Cherry at davidarnettcherry.com.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Andy Wawo looks a scream. Hand him on my wo-o-o-o. Andy Wawo, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is sculptor Jacob Hashimoto. His new works, The City and the Sky, are now on view permanently at the Portland International Airport in the new Concourse E. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Jacob.
Oh, well, it's great to be here. I'm happy to talk about the new artworks.
You are a very well-known artist for public installation work. Usually your work consists of lots of things hanging from the ceiling, and that's exactly what we have at the new Concourse Terminal E. It's a very bright, airy space, and they've given you two beautiful locations. They're in the sort of pointy part of the roof, so you've got a lot of height, and they're next to huge windows, beautiful windows. So you've been dealing with great visibility and great light. Just tell us a bit about the first of the two that you see. It's called The City.
Well, as you walk into the new concourse, you encounter this piece that we're calling The City. And it's made of about 6,000 individual elements that are either, you know, rectangular or circular or elliptical. And they create this kind of hanging canopy that extends from one end of what they're calling, the architects call them the nodes of the concourse. So there's two nodes. This is the first node that you encounter. And this first piece, The City, is based on kind of a map of Portland written in the sky. And so you encounter it as like, and it's frenetic and it's full of color and like lots of iconography from around Portland, but also lots of iconography from my own work. So it's really, it's dense and complex and you know, hopefully amazing.
So just, I mean, one obvious thing is there are little samples almost of the old Portland carpet. What are the kind of bits of the city translate into images that are hanging from the ceiling?
Well, I mean, clearly we wanted to have some references to the city. I should give you a little background on kind of how the artwork works in general. So typically, you know, I've been making this work for like 20 years and so I have this huge kind of library of my own language that I bring to any kind of project. And every time I start with a new sort of public artwork, you know, there's an opportunity to add to this library, add to this language. And usually it's the kind of choices, design choices that I make in that direction are based on, you know, where the piece is, how people are going to relate to it, all of that information. And so each time we make a huge library of additional information for the sculptures. And for the city in particular, which has a lot of new iconography, we went in and looked at kind of, you know, the stereotypical icons of Portland, but also looked at the way that the map of Portland and the topography could inform the kind of design making decisions. So one thing that we all know about Portland is it's a city of rivers, you know, and so there's an opportunity to create these kind of floating rivers through the sky above the viewer that map against the kind of actual rivers, you know, the confluence of rivers that define Portland as a city. And, you know, as part of this kind of city of waterways, we all know that the bridge system in Portland is incredibly important and really an iconic way of, mm-hmm. you know, talking about how you even navigate the city. You know, if I'm riding my bike from point A to point B, I know which bridge I'm crossing. you know, and so we built a whole series of graphics based on the specific bridges in the city, you know, the Burnside Bridge and you know, others. So, and those are located in this map. And I keep talking about the piece as a map, and I should explain that the footprint of the piece is as seen from above. So if you flew over the top of the sculpture, the shape of the artwork is the shape of Portland right now. So it maps the city limits as defined at this point.
So if you lay down on your back on the Barrazzo floor and looked up, is that how it would look, like a right way around map of Portland?
Yeah, it would be as if you were underneath the city of Portland looking up. That's if you were lying on the terrazzo. If you're above it looking down, then it looks like an aerial view of Portland.
Oh, okay. Wow. That's an interesting perspective.
Yeah, it's like the underbelly of the city or something. And, you know, so we have roses and a whole bunch of things. Plus, you know, the iconic Portland carpet had to make an appearance, you know, in the artwork too. It was an opportunity to kind of sample it for as part of the language that we were using.
Yeah. So, for instance, there are a lot of small circles. I don't know how big they are, like 6 inches across?
They are 9 inches across. So across. They're bigger than they look.
Yeah. And the typical material that you made these out of, it kind of looks like rice paper or this sort of translucent white stuff. What is that?
In this case, it's resin. Typically, like, I started this body of work in the late 90s. And all of those early pieces were rice paper. They're rice paper glued on bamboo frames. But as the artwork grew into these sculptures that occupied public spaces, you know, we started having to change the materials to adapt for kind of practical necessities of, you know, of cleaning and maintenance and durability. So we switched to resin. And in this case, all of the colors are just poured resin into these frames, into bamboo frames. And then there's a ton of different complex graphic images, and all of those are actually either screen prints or UV cured inkjet prints on rice paper, and that rice paper is then embedded into the resin kite as the resin is being poured. So it gives you this kind of feeling of paper without kind of the durability issues of kind of raw paper.
Yeah. So what does white represent up here?
Well, I think in this case, it's the notion of these clouds drifting across the city, or fog, or, you know, mist in this case.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay, so it's not strictly a map. It's a map with clouds.
It's a map with landscapes, yeah. It's like a city in mist.
Yeah, okay.
And in large part, you know, that language started out of this use of the ellipse as kind of a cloud form, you know, started as kind of an art historical reference to the way we think about, or like in Asian culture and Japanese culture specifically, people who are painting screens would use these cloud-like forms to kind of bridge between gaps in narrative, time passing, all of those sorts of things. So,
oh, yeah, I've heard that before, right? In long poems, the illustrator would just put clouds in the text.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just shows time moving on, you know, the passage of a moment or a transition of a theme to another theme. And so it's kind of the connective tissue of this whole structure that we built.
Yeah. And then, and still looking at the city, I see like a black square, one of the lowest pieces. It looks like a black square from the angle I'm looking. And there's kind of a parallel green one just above it.
Right.
Made of squares.
Right.
It could be a rhombus, but it's made of squares, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
What does that represent?
Well, I don't think that it represents specifically anything. I think, I guess we could argue that it represents kind of a certain aspect of art history that we think about in terms of grid-based abstraction and hard edge painting, and, you know, which is where the kind of foundation of this language comes out of. You know, the whole artwork is this kind of landscape-based abstract object that is built out of, you know, my personal history, the kind of history of post-World War II American abstraction, and, you know, these sort of iconic patterns and textures from like pan-global cultures. So I think that, you know, in this case, you know, typically because the work does come out of this sort of language of post-war American abstraction, there's always this foundation of minimalism, you know, and the sense of like Donald Judd is built into that as part of the kind of foundational language. And, you know, people like Saul LeWitt are also built in because it's, you know, it's grid-based abstractions using the XYZ coordinate to create these kind of sculptural spaces.
Yeah, but a 3D grid, because you hang them from the ceiling at different heights, okay? Mm-hmm. So the viewer should imagine a sort of undulating landscape hanging from the ceiling.
Right.
It's so 3D, it's kind of amazing.
Well, I mean, what's cool about it is that the whole thing is based on kind of a, so each of the, you're saying it's a square made up of squares, which is true. And the module, the hanging module, is a bunch of squares that are offset, turned in different directions as the piece kind of ascends and descends through the space. And it has a kind of, because it's built of these kind of squares made out of squares, it has a very kind of Minecraft sort of three-dimensional quality to it, you know, that's really familiar to people these days. And it's kind of the way that we, you know, if we're thinking about contemporary landscape and that represents representations of landscapes in the contemporary era, it's really hard to like divorce yourself from the kinds of crafted spaces that kind of emerge from video game culture. And I think that that's also a huge part of the language that we're talking about, because those spaces are built three-dimensionally in these kinds of, you know, illustration engines using these kind of XYZ coordinate systems, you know, to kind of craft these versions of reality for us.
Mm-hmm. Do you play Minecraft?
Oh yeah, for sure. I played a lot of Minecraft for a long time.
What do you play, creative?
Survival mode. My wife and I play a lot of survival mode. We actually did a video with Minecraft recently, because we did a piece at the Oklahoma Science Museum. They found us and came to us to talk to us about how to shoot a video about how, you know, does this sculpture language actually functioned in the world of Minecraft and what it related to in terms of those references. And so I think that, you know, part of that language is going to feel very familiar to people that come and see these pieces.
Yeah. Where could we see that video?
I think it's called In the Mind of a Minecrafter, and you could just type in my name.
Mm-hmm. Oh, cool.
And it should link to it on YouTube. It's like, it's part of the Minecraft channel.
Yeah. So the second piece is called The Sky. It's a bit further down towards the end, and it's mostly white. Mm-hmm. It's a lot deeper. That means it hangs lower, I think, and it's narrower. And the bottom section, so nearest your head, is a kind of scattering of greens and blues.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks a lot simpler, but to just tell why, what's the, you know, why'd you pick those colors? Why is the sky green?
Well, so what you can't see from the images and what people will be able to see when they walk underneath it is that the greens and the blues are actually, the greens are drawings of native grasses from the region that we've abstracted into these green graphics that are screen printed onto rice paper. And they create this kind of sense of a floating field of grass above your head. And the blue pieces are actually these elliptical kites that have little mountain sorts of iconography in the little brown mountain-like objects kind of floating on a blue field. And so it's this intersection of kind of the plains and the mountain and the Cascades, really, mm-hmm. at the base. You know, as we look south, you know, you look out the window there and you see Mount Hood. So it's as you look, you know, towards the mountain, you see this mountain range across the artwork as well. And then it extends into the sky in this kind of diaphanous cloud that just stretches up into the architecture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's got a very, I think, simple. I like to say essential character. But it's very different than the city. It's more kind of calming and airy and light, and you know, really is kind of, you know, about this kind of sense of the grandness of the sky kind of rolling out above you. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was by intention that it was kind of more elegant and essential relative to the sky, which is kind of a little more frenetic and chaotic.
City or the sky? Which did you mean just then?
The sky is more frenetic than the city, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Less frenetic than the city, I'm sorry. It's going to be all juggled up.
The sky seems, I mean, you use mostly circles. I think it's all circles, right? The little kites.
Yeah, they're ellipses, actually. They appear like circles, kind of foreshortened.
And they're not as in regular grid pattern. They seem to be more...
You sit underneath it, you can actually see that the grid on both pieces is exactly the same. And the... But they weave together much more seamlessly because they're not jumping heights as much. So they kind of weave, they feel like kind of a continuous canopy as opposed to a bunch of grids that are twisted in different directions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's part of the reason, the way that it was designed. And then there's this kind of reverse wave that drifts up through the backside of the piece that you see through all these thousands of blue fiberglass rods that support the whole structure.
Mm-hmm. My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is sculptor Jacob Hashimoto, and he's talking about his newly opened or newly installed pieces at the Portland International Airport on Concourse E, and they're called The City and the Sky. Jacob, we're talking about the sky. How would you think a traveler is going to experience this? Because beneath there's going to be a big Stumptown coffee shop. Right now it's just because the coffee shop and some of the concessions have not opened because of the recession. I mean, is there a perfect angle to view this from?
I don't think that there's a perfect angle. I think that it does, you know, it does different things for different moments. And I think that's part of the strength of the work in this space, is that if you're sitting underneath it, you know, just hanging out, waiting to get on a plane or waiting to meet people, you know, you have a certain experience. And when you walk down the corridor, coming or going, you have an entirely different experience. And so I think that it's, it just transforms as you move through it. And that's kind of the nice thing about this kind of large scale installation sculpture, is that your presence as a viewer kind of creates this unique experience for you based on kind of your narrative through the airport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in terms of the Stumptown kiosk, you know, we know that that's going in, and we knew that it was planned. So part of the reason that I think this piece appears to be moving, it moves up higher and kind of vaults into the ceiling faster than the city.
Yeah,
it's because we had to accommodate this, you know, some restrictions on our design to accommodate this Stumptown kiosk. But what I was saying, you know, when we presented this artwork, was that the huge advantage to this kind of landscape-based sculpture is that the Stumptown kiosk and the rest of the airport just become part of the sculpture in the end. So it's like when you're making a sculpture of the sky and you put an object in the room with it, it's still a sculpture of the sky, you know, it's still can do what it's mandated. And I think it's going to make their kiosk look pretty cool.
Oh, okay. You know what, if it ends up being a Starbucks, do you care?
I'd much rather have a Stumptown than a Starbucks, but, you know.
But you have no say in the final look of what sits beneath your sculpture.
No, we have no say in that at all. That's, you know, we're trusting that, you know, the wise people at the port will protect us a little bit. I think that most of the signage and everything has already been established. So
yeah.
They've been very cool to work with, and they really, you know, are proud of the airport as a facility. And I think that, you know, we trust them to take care and make things function as well as possible.
And I want the listeners to know that all these pieces of these little white circles and green and blue, they're hanging from the ceiling on these blue rods. Just tell us about the rods. And the whole thing looked like a mobile, right? But
mm-hmm.
I don't think this moves in the breeze, this work.
it moves in the incredibly powerful air conditioning, I think, a little bit. But I, you know, for the most part, yeah, it's static. And so the blue rods, this is actually the first time we've used them, because the Port of Portland wanted some assurance that we would be able to kind of do complex maintenance on the piece if we needed to. And which means taking it up and putting it back down in parts to clean or do whatever, replace things. So instead of using what we usually use, which is a braided Kevlar cord, we decided to design this piece around these quarter inch blue fiberglass rods. And they hang down from the ceiling from these custom made pieces of stainless steel hardware that we actually had made in Spokane. And then each kite, I call them kites, each of these discs mounts on with what we call offsets, which are these little cylindrical pieces of hardware that are screwed into the face of each element. And they're, I mean, they're literally thousands and thousands of them. It's an overwhelming number.
So I think the best thing a listener could do is just go to jake@hashimoto.com. where they have beautiful photos of all this type of work that you've done. One that jumped out to me when I was looking is the Willis Tower in Chicago, Illinois. And the piece is called In the Heart of This Infinite Particle of Galactic Dust. This is 2019. It's a muted color scheme of grays, whites, and browns. What was the commission there, and how much freedom did you have?
The commission, it's an interesting story, because the this is formerly the Sears Tower in Chicago, which is one of the iconic buildings in this country. And for many, many years, there was a gigantic Calder sculpture in that space. And when it got embroiled in this, all this litigation as to who owns it. And finally, they had to, everybody was fighting over this thing, and they had to take it out. And it's like an incredible, I mean, I went to art school in Chicago, so I know this sculpture really well. And it was just like, it was kind of scandalous that it got removed from the building. And so this was going on, and then somebody, the new owners of the building contacted me about potentially being the person to come in to replace this Calder. And we went in, and they're doing a huge renovation to the lower section of the building. And so we got to come in really when those, when the lobby was completely gutted down to the studs. So you could see, and down to the studs in this case means down to these gigantic I-beams that support the whole building. And, you know, the company was incredibly generous in terms of the way that they approached the design process, and they really let me design whatever I wanted. And in fact, they redesigned the entire ceiling structure for us, changed all the ventilation systems, the lighting, in order to support the artwork that I proposed to them. And what I said when I actually presented them with my final design, it wasn't exactly what they had asked for in our meetings, but it was the artwork that I wanted to make for them. And the reason was that, you know, when I was in school in Chicago, it's when this whole body of work started. And I have a very specific kind of narrative about, you know, moving from Walla Walla, Washington to Chicago to go to school, and this, and the loss of landscape, and the loss of the sky, and the loss of, you know, all of those things that kind of my imagination had been built on for the first like 20 years of my life. And I started building these first, you know, kind of hanging sculptures when I was in Chicago as kind of meditations on, you know, big sky country and kind of a return to home.
Yeah, and where are you from?
I'm from Walla Walla, Washington. So you know, I'm, you know, in, on the east side, we have these huge, you know, vistas. You know, as you gaze down the length of the Walla Walla Valley, it's just clouds and sky, you know, and the curve of the earth, the curve of the valley moving up to the horizon. And I think I was trying to capture a lot of that language. So the early earliest canopy pieces were kind of built on this nostalgia for the Pacific Northwest. And when I would go to school, I remember coming out of the subway in Chicago and looking up in the sky and seeing these little windows of clouds passing above the sky or above the tops of the buildings. And I wanted to kind of create a portrait of it. And so for this project, I really wanted to create kind of a portrait of the night sky as these clouds floating over the city reflected by the city lights. So it's these kind of white amber clouds floating across this space. And if you look closely at this piece, it's as if the clouds have separated and you can see the slash of the Milky Way going across diagonally across the artwork, because it's each one of the blue pieces is actually printed with a drawing of stars, and they're in all different densities, as they come to the center, they kind of get denser and denser in this kind of rippling wave that goes through the center of very dense star patterns.
Yeah. Now this is wishful thinking, right? You would never see the Milky Way in downtown.
No, and that's part of it too, is that you would never see a star probably from downtown Chicago.
Yeah. But,
before the city, you could probably lie on your back and see it really well.
But just quickly, if there's a young artist out there with ambition to do big public work, what advice would you give them to be successful in it? Because I imagine you're dealing with bureaucracy and,
I think that you need to understand that this is a collaboration, and that you need to understand that this is a collaboration between you and the facility, you and the architect, you and the engineer, you and the city in this case. And that if you think that you are not going to have to compromise, you're probably going to find yourself in a really difficult position. Mm-hmm. It also makes the artwork better if you have a really good dialogue with the people that you're working with. And we've been really fortunate on the last number of projects working with great teams of people that really believed in the work and really pushed and championed it. And I think that that's made all the difference in the world to me as an artist, because it allowed me to be more creative, to create kind of more complex work, more kind of challenging work. In terms of getting into public artwork, there's a huge amount of opportunity in public artwork. And, in post-COVID, it might be some of the, during this year, in the next couple of years, it might be some of the only artwork that people encounter on a regular basis. So I think that, having access to public artwork is a huge, gift these days. And what's cool about it too is it, opens you to an audience of people that, might not look at art in their everyday life, and they encounter it and they criticize it and they have this relationship to it. They love it, they hate it. All of that stuff is so rich and important as part of like a community to have something to talk about, even if, it's something that's completely detestable. Mm-hmm. You're part of this kind of dialogue around the city or around like whatever community you're in.
I think what's good now is that they can just Google it and read about it. No longer mysterious abstract art, plunked down from nowhere. They can sort of enjoy it more, I think, by understanding it.
With these artworks in particular, I hope that, even if you just encountered it cold and you walked in there and you're just like bleary-eyed off your four flights from Europe or whatever, and you walk into this space, that you would have some sort of kind of immediate sort of physical, visceral relationship with this object that doesn't require any art history and doesn't require any sort of, primer. You just show up and experience it, and walk through it, and it's part of the landscape of Portland. So,
mm-hmm. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Jacob Hashimoto. His two new sculptures, The City and The Sky, are on view now permanently at Portland International Airport in Concourse E. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus by Zoom, Jacob.
Thank you, Joseph. I appreciate it.
Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, looks a scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Portland.